Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. On today's episode, I sit down with Dr. Joseph Parks. He is the current medical director at the National Council for Mental Well-Being in Washington, D.C. Founded in 1969, the National Council is an organization that drives policy and social change on behalf of mental health and substance use treatment centers. They work to gather federal funding on behalf of these centers, as well as advocate for policies that ensure people with mental illness have access to comprehensive, high-quality care. So many of the episodes we've done have been really first-person accounts, so it's nice to have a more informational episode. So to start off, what is the National Council?
So the National Council is an organization that represents over 3,500 organizations that do treatment for substance use disorder and mental illness nationally. Ranging all the way from small rural clinics to substance use disorder treatment centers to large hospital systems and FQHCs.
And so what kind of policies do you guys advocate for?
We advocate for policies that will really make mental well-being, including recovery from substance use challenges, a reality for everyone. And by mental well-being, we mean people should be able to thrive regardless of having a mental health or substance use challenge. And it includes promoting preventive care and increasing access to services.
Okay, so you are located in Washington, D.C., correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so how long has the National Council been around? And give me a little bit more background on what you do specifically there.
Yeah, so the National Council has been around for over 50 years now. I'm the medical director for the National Council. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, and my job is to connect policy with the clinical on the ground.
Okay, cool. Why do we need mental health care from your point of view?
Well, it's actually the most common cause of functional impairment, disability, and distress in people under the age of 40. That's when chronic medical illnesses start catching up with people more, but people in their 20s and 30s are much more likely to be impaired or distressed due to anxiety, depression, or substance use challenges than they are from heart disease or diabetes. These are illnesses that come to people earlier in life.
And mental illness does tend to be invisible, and many times people don't really know that they're suffering from mental illness. If that makes sense?
Absolutely. And it has that in common with the early stages of many chronic medical illnesses. People don't initially know they have hypertension or diabetes, but it is certainly destroying their health silently by not identifying it and treating it early in the course. And we need to do the same thing with mental illness. Just like we check your blood pressure early, even if we don't think you have a problem, we check it. We should be checking on you to see how you're doing in terms of your mental well-being, both from mental illness and from substance use disorder challenges.
Yeah. Why do you think that isn't really a conversation or doesn't happen in the physician's office? A lot of people don't even go in for their yearly exam, but I feel like most times when I've gone in, especially as a child and a teenager, they didn't really ask me about my mental health.
That's true. And there's actually guidance to pediatricians that they should be asking about that. But, pediatricians and family practice docs and general practitioners, we expect them to do so much. Mm-hmm. And we give them so little time to check on it. They're supposed to back up and check on everything. And frankly, we don't give them the time with us or the supports they need to check on everything that would be best, including people's use of drugs or alcohol and their mental distress.
Yeah. So talking about substance issues and substance abuse, is that looked at as a mental health issue from your point of view and from the National Council's point of view?
You know, that gets controversial. There's people that say it's one kind of mental illness, and there's people that say it's another kind of illness. In any case, it's a serious illness that affects people's behavior, their health. If you have a substance use disorder, you're more likely to have a mental illness. If you have a mental illness, you're more likely to have a substance use disorder. I think it's kind of a fine intellectual point as to whether we lump them together or see them as in somewhat different categories.
Separate. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Can you discuss a little bit, I mean, you're a psychiatrist and a doctor, can you discuss mental health issues being hereditary and kind of nature versus nurture for my listeners? Just a little bit more background.
You know, like so many other things in health, it is definitely a combination of genetics and the kind of life you've been handed or found for yourself. It's kind of how we came out and then what happened to us after that. Some people have more pre-existing genetic vulnerabilities and other people have more post-birth traumas and challenges than others. And that can either be personal in the family or out in your community or just accidents that happen to you. There's excellent research on early trauma in childhood showing that it significantly increases the incidence of substance use and mental disorder, even in identical twins. You know, that's the gold standard of is it genetics or is it life, is studies of twins who have been separated at birth. It's both. So you can be double lucky or you could be double unlucky.
Yeah. And I think that really goes to show the invisible part of it is, you know, people can really be struggling and people around them may not know.
And I use the word luck for a reason, because people often get judgmental about things around behaviors, mental illness, substance use, thinking, oh, you should just get a grip on it. Mm-hmm. And so much of how healthy we are is luck. It's luck of the draw. What genetics did I get? What card was I drawn with that? And then what kind of life did I get? You know, was I traumatized? Did I have resources? Did I have people taking care of me? Did I get those lucky breaks or did I get the unlucky ones? And it's, we shouldn't be, if we're doing very well, we would do well to acknowledge the role fortune paved into it and not think it's all about how wonderful and how hard we worked ourselves, which does help, but it's not everything.
Well, exactly. You're speaking to privilege, and I think that's a great point. And we can get into even more like accessibility of mental health resources. And if you're unlucky in some of the things you just talked about, it's harder to access those resources to get better, to seek out care. It's a financial issue, and love to hear you speak more on that.
Well, you know, it's certainly like most of healthcare in this country, it certainly is a financial issue, and the quality of care you get depends on your financial resources and the resources of the community you live in, because we all tend to get our healthcare close to home and in the communities we live in. You know, their insurance coverage is better for mental illnesses than they've ever been in the past.
Okay.
On the other hand, there are real problems with having enough mental health providers, psychiatrists, therapists, substance use counselors, who are available with open time slots on the insurance panels. In many insurance panels, you call up your insurer, urge all your listeners, if they have insurance, call up and call the list of psychiatrists that's on the provider search page and see who could take you in the next 3 to 7 days. I bet you'll have a hard time finding somebody. That is a challenge. Demand is up. And the rates are too low. The commercial insurance rates that the companies pay therapists, psychiatrists, and substance use counselors is often lower than what they could get on the cash market. So they ask for cash.
No, I mean, that's a great point. So I'm on Lexapro personally, and to refill my Lexapro, because it was so difficult to make an appointment with a psychiatrist that I had been working with, and mm-hmm. honestly, it was expensive. The psychiatrist mm-hmm. I worked with, who I started the medication with, didn't take insurance. So now I just see a general physician who takes my insurance, and I see him probably once every 3 months, and he'll just refill my Lexapro for the next couple months. What do you tell people who don't have that accessibility, who can't pay for a therapist, pay for a psychiatrist out of pocket? And is that kind of the work that the National Council is doing?
That is the work we're doing. I would tell those people they deserve better. We're working to get them better access to care at reasonable prices than that. And that is what our signature initiative, Certified Community Behavioral Health Centers, are about. You know, they have a different rate setting methodology, so they are actually paid a rate high enough to hire therapists and psychiatrists at competition with the cash market. They can pay what the local market prevails. They don't have these artificially low rates that we see in Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial insurance that suppress access, that don't let people get access to the service they need. But the good news is that there's been a rapid expansion of certified community behavioral health centers. I would urge your listeners to go to the National Council for Mental Wellbeing website and look up CCBHC, and you'll see that we're up to now over 400, about 430 nationally. And that's up from just around under 100 only 2 years ago. They are expanding rapidly, but they need to be made available in every state. It is a Medicaid program. So okay. The downside is it's only available to people with Medicaid coverage. Now, the good side is certified community behavioral health centers are required by the Medicaid rules to accept people with other insurance. They're required to have a broad range of services, not just do one thing. They have to do both take care of mental illness, they have to take care of substance use disorders, they have to do kids, they have to do adults, they have to have mobile crisis, they have to have extended hours in the evenings and on weekends, and they have to see people promptly. They can't give you an appointment months out. And the way they manage to do all this is, again, they have a different rate methodology. So they actually can offer you, you couldn't get a psychiatrist from your insurance company because the going rate on the coast is about $300 an hour. And the commercial companies are paying about $180 an hour. Well, of course, the psychiatrists are going to fill up if they can with cash on somebody that can pay them at $300. You know, this different rate methodology allows competitive employment.
And so you work with mental health and substance programs across the country to set up their programs or follow certain rules or gain funding from the U.S. government. Can you talk me through? I'm trying to understand.
Yes. Yeah, we our biggest work is advocating for them at a national level with Congress. You know, Congress spent billions of dollars on the CCBHC program, and that took a lot of information explaining, bringing people in from around the country to explain why this was needed and how this particular model would help. The second thing we do is we provide training and technical assistance to any agencies that either want to do this work or become better at how they do it now, whether that's setting up, whether that's the initial application to get the right methodology, or whether that's getting better at improving more access, at doing more mobile crisis services, at doing better coordinated care. You know, it's so common for one doctor not to know what the other doctor's doing. And that's another thing the certified community behavioral health centers are responsible for, are making sure that all your healthcare providers know the whole range of treatment you're getting so mistakes don't occur.
Yeah, so they're interconnected. I mean, that is such a problem. Like, you know, I go and see a random physician that I find on like an app. I use this app or website, ZocDoc, and it usually will show you the doctor who's closest to you that's available in the next couple of days. So if I'm in a pinch, I'll use that and it takes my insurance. But they're not talking to my general practitioner. They're not talking to my therapist. So there's no connection of what I'm actually dealing with or what health issues besides the intake forms.
Yeah. And unless you remember to tell them some of your medical history, they'll never know it. They depend on your memory. And if you're getting treated for depression, well, part of the symptoms are trouble with memory and concentration and keeping things organized if you're really depressed.
Do you think this is changing as we computerize healthcare?
It is changing. It is changing very rapidly. There were just some changes that happened earlier this spring that where federal regulations prohibit healthcare providers from not exchanging information about you unless you've told them not to.
Okay.
Before they could if they wanted to, but they didn't have to. Now they have to unless you as the patient say, no, don't tell those other people about what I told you.
Now it's easier than ever to access people's file and medical history than before when you'd each hospital or doctor would have, you know, 100 pages of paperwork per patient.
It is getting much easier. The data fields are standardized, and the health information networks are doing better at exchanging the basic information, like your diagnosis, your medications, what services you got from who on what date. And just this spring, they added the ability to exchange progress note information, information about individual visits. By 2023, they'll be required to be able to export and exchange your entire medical record
Oh, wow.
to another physician. And you still will have the right to say, no, I don't want you to do that. Hold on to mine. But if you don't say that, that exchange will happen. And frankly, as a practicing doc, I've seen many people, more people harmed because information wasn't shared
Shared, yeah.
than I've ever seen that were harmed because it was shared.
Do you feel like there's a lot of stigma even within the mental health community and people who work within it?
I think there's some. I think it is changing with the person's age. I think people in your generation are much less ashamed of having a mental illness or a substance use problem, are much more willing to ask for help, and are much less likely to judge others than boomers like myself. I think we've seen some steady reductions in the prejudice and the discrimination against people with these problems. It's very heartening. That's one of the coolest things that's been happening in the last 10, 15 years.
Do you feel like care is approached differently as younger generations come up and we're talking more about this? And, you know, when I was younger, I never knew the language to tell my doctors or tell anyone around me how I was feeling. I didn't know what anxiety meant, and now I do. So, you know, language and knowledge really is power.
Yeah, and so now you know not only how to help somebody else, but how to help yourself too. And it probably led to you seeking care earlier. I think education early through the schools is very important. You know, our other signature initiative at the National Council is mental health first aid. And it is a standard training education course for the general public. It's kind of like the mental health version of Red Cross first aid.
Okay.
It teaches you how to identify when somebody's distressed, gives you some idea of the differences between a depression or a mania or a psychosis. And you actually get to role play. You get to practice how to talk to somebody in a way that's reassuring so they calm down enough to work with you to get connected to to get some help, basically. It doesn't make you a therapist, but it helps you see when somebody's in trouble and know enough. You know, it's like Red Cross first aid. Oh, you're not supposed to bleed. Let me stop that. Now let's find somebody that can stitch.
Yeah, this is how I do CPR.
Yeah.
I mean, why don't they teach this in schools?
You know, our newest initiative, Teen Mental Health First Aid, is going to do just that. It's going to roll out nationally in the next couple months. And we have one program that's for adults to teach kids, and then we have another one for older teens to teach each other directly. So we're looking to change that in the coming year and to make this common knowledge everywhere so we can take care of each other. You know, I want to say one more thing about why people are seeking more care and less stigmatizing. I think there's a much better understanding in the last 10 to 20 years that these are treatable illnesses, that there's a range of treatments available and treatments work. I think we stigmatize illnesses that make us feel helpless, that we don't know what to do about. Back at the beginning of the HIV epidemic, there was horrible stigmatization. But once we figured out how to treat it, so it's just one more illness to treat, it's not nearly as stigmatized anymore. And I think we've turned that corner with treating depression, anxiety, psychosis, and substance use disorders. People understand that these treatments are effective and they can get substantial help, so they don't push it away and say, oh, it must be something bad and not about me. We get a little crazy when we feel helpless.
Well, I also think there's so much more research and science behind mental illness. Before, once again, because it's invisible, I know I keep saying that, people didn't believe. I mean, I grew up around people who didn't believe that mental illness really existed. And there was a lot of stigma just around that. You know, just calm down, or they should just stop drinking or stop doing drugs. And it's like, no, there's actual research that a lot of the times it is brain chemistry, and so much of this stuff is coming out. I think that's really helping with the destigmatization. That's like, these are re this is real science, real illness.
Yeah, because if there was an illness, then the brain would be the only organ in the body that didn't get sick. Every other organ you got gets sick.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid your brain's the same as the rest of you.
And so those programs you were just telling me about, similar to the Red Cross, the ones you're starting to implement, where are those going? Public schools across the country?
You can go to our website, Mental Health First Aid at the National Council for Well-Being, and you can find a training near you somewhere. They are in all types of different venues. A number of companies are doing them in the workplace. Walgreens is doing them with their pharmacists. Delta is doing it with some of their employees. They are available in general in the community. We used to do them all in person, and recently we've been doing them all virtual, but we have hybrid models also. The training can go anywhere from 4 hours to 2 days. So there's a lot of options out there, but for any of your listeners, look up Mental Health First Aid and you'll find, and there's a functionality on the website that'll let you find training near you. It's all over.
Okay, cool. And if this starts to be implemented into schools, do you feel like we will see a change in the next 5, 10, 15 years? And do you feel like the rates of mental illness aren't actually matching how many people suffer from mental illness?
So I think the demand for treatment for substance use disorders and mental illness has increased dramatically over the last 10 years, and of course during the COVID epidemic. Part of that was releasing pent-up demand. You know, if you're willing to say, you know, I shouldn't feel this lousy all the time and not be able to think straight, then you're going to go look for treatment. And that could look like a new case because you were hiding it all the time before.
Yeah.
On the other hand, COVID has been very traumatizing. We felt helpless, we're trapped, and that leads to depression and anxiety. Huge increases in overdose, huge increases in substance use disorders, just as people attempt to deal with their distress by the means they have at hand, even if it's not too good a choice.
And so, can you talk a little bit more about the substance abuse programs that the National Council works with? So, is it similar to what you're doing with the mental health programs, or yeah, what do you do with those that's different?
Very much so. But you know, the big change in substance use disorder is until fairly recently, it was all about therapy, individual and group therapy, substance abuse counseling, 12-step programs. And now there's been a real increase in options to use medication in addition to therapy. And there's studies showing you do best when you get both.
Okay. Yeah.
Huge, huge advances in treating opiate disorders with buprenorphine. Before we had methadone, and buprenorphine is a much more flexible drug that allows people to live with less restrictions. A lot, there's still a huge underuse of medications for treating alcohol problems. We're just in the early phases of figuring out how to use medication to help people with stimulant abuse. But there's been a lot more research and a lot more elegant way to approach it than counseling alone. Not to say counseling isn't great, it's important, it works. But it's nice to have more than one tool in your toolbox.
Yeah. And so for someone who's listening to this episode who is struggling with substance abuse or substance issues, what would you tell them?
I would say that there are effective treatments out there. You don't have to feel out of control and helpless. You don't have to do it alone. You have choices. There are therapies and groups that'll help. There are apps that'll help. There are medications that will help. And like any illness, you need to step up and get some assistance and then find the assistance that works best for you. You may have to try more than one therapist or substance abuse counselor. You may have to try more than one medication. But a lot of illnesses are like that. A lot of people have tried more than one antihypertensive before they find the right one.
Before they
But you can get moderate, significant relief and get control of your life again.
And so, for someone who's listening that says, yeah, that all sounds good, but I can't afford that treatment or I can't afford to take time off from my job, what would you tell them?
You know, if you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to be able to keep going back to the job. And we talk to employers a lot about that. You know, these are the illnesses that interfere with people's functioning at work the most. In terms of the expense, I would urge them to go to their local community mental health center. Almost all states provide some level of funding for the underinsured and uninsured. I would urge them to see if there's a certified community behavioral health center near them. I would urge them, if not, then to check on to see if there's a community health center or a federally qualified health center. Those are also supported by federal funding and are there specifically for the uninsured and underinsured.
I mean, I think this is such important information, and I'm so happy to have you on. And I think this is a really different episode than we've had before, and I think this is going to reach a lot of people. I want to talk a little bit about jail and prison and how that has become kind of psychiatric holdings for a lot of people with mental illness.
Yeah, you know, that was part of what the war on drugs did for us. We had people that had treatable drug problems, and we decided to call them crimes as much as we could. And so, and there's a lot of those problems. So we ended up with a lot of people in jail at a much higher expense than it would have been to treat them to begin with.
Yeah. And so why is that happening? We just don't have the psychiatric care. I actually just spent the last week in Los Angeles. And, you know, when you're driving around LA, they have an enormous homeless population. And the majority of the homeless population is struggling with mental illness. And it seems like why isn't the government stepping in to give these people care and access? Because a lot of this is a mental health issue.
And some of it, frankly, is a housing issue. I mean, the price of housing is astronomical in California. And the availability of housing is almost as bad as the availability of psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. You know, much of what leads to anxiety and depression are what we call social determinants of health. Not having money makes people depressed and anxious just on its own. And we do not have the same support for people to have a minimum livable income, for people to have housing. And often when they get their health care, it impoverishes them. There's other countries, people don't go bankrupt because they need health care.
Definitely. And if one person just doesn't have that safety net, you know, maybe they don't have a family member that lives nearby. So if they can't pay their rent, they don't have someone they could go stay with.
Yeah. And medical debt is the major reason people go bankrupt or fail to pay their mortgage or fail to make their car payment. It is the most common reason for running into financial problem is having a medical bill you can't cover. And it makes people depressed and anxious above and beyond whatever other illness they had before they got the medical bill.
I completely agree with you. Do you feel like if we had either single payer healthcare would help fix this problem or just healthcare for all in this country? I mean, we're such a wealthy country. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I think we're here to take care of each other, and that's something best done together. And I think many religions teach that as a moral imperative, and we're not doing very good on living up to that in this country.
Yeah. Do you believe that our mental health problems truly curable, or should the goal just be to manage them?
There are people that get lifetime remissions, but it's more common to get substantial improvement and need ongoing treatment. I get a biased sample. I'm a psychiatrist, so I only see the people that got really sick and kept getting sick time and time again. I don't see all the people. About half of people, if you look at the research, that get a major depression, have a single episode, and don't get depressed again. But of the other half that get depressed a second time, two-thirds of them get a third episode. And of that group, it's usually a recurring illness. I had a friend in college who dropped out of University of Michigan and then Wayne State Law School due to a psychotic episode. And has never been psychotic again. It took him like 8 years to get back together, and it did take a chunk out of his career and life trajectory, but he has not had a repeat episode. So people do have single episodes. I think we just don't think about them because they go on with life.
Yeah, definitely. Or people are struggling with certain mental illnesses that can be managed really well with medication. I mean, I feel like people who are kind of in the schizoid.
Yes.
That they, I mean, you can speak more to this, but they can be managed by medication sometimes and have phenomenal results.
Well, the great thing about mental illness is most medical problems, the older you get, the worse they get. You know, diabetes does not get better. It stabilizes, then slowly gets worse. The same with hypertension also. There are many people who, even if they don't get complete relief, are substantially better in their 40s and 50s than they were in their 20s and 30s. Their moods are more stable.
Why is that?
It's the natural course of the illness. Sometimes people get better. We get them younger, but they don't always get worse.
Okay, that's interesting. I wonder if also, like, I know with borderline personality disorder, for example, when someone with that gets older, usually, and they get married, it tends to stabilize out.
Also, borderline personality disorder is very treatable. It's not a quick, easy treatment. The person has to work, and it takes some fairly elegant therapies. But most people are substantially better 10 to 15 years after they were diagnosed than in the first few years after a diagnosis. It's quite treatable.
Quite treatable. I mean, that's great to know that. And also, I mean, I feel like some of these illnesses didn't even exist or no one knew what they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now there's so much research coming in.
And I'm sure we're going to have that increase in knowledge 30 to 40 years from now. We'll have subdivided depressions into different causes or underlying mechanisms. That's just the way medical science works. I'm sure there were all those people with those problems that were deeply miserable in
of
the
course.
Same old way. We just weren't clever enough to parse them out into different buckets.
Yeah. What do you view as the most underdiagnosed mental health issue affecting people today?
Oh, I think the one we see least in the treatment system is probably social phobia. And also just the single phobias. People that have intense, unreasonable fears of something are very common. Now, if it's a fairly rare something that's easy to avoid, it doesn't impair them very much. Mm-hmm. But there are many people that barely ever leave their home. They're just quietly holed up there because when they go outside, they become intensely uncomfortable. But, you know, all these just describe patterns of anxiety. I don't think we really have the science at this point to know the underlying causes. And some of these things we now have different names for, we may ultimately decide had the same underlying cause when we have more research and know a little more.
And so how does the medical research in this country work? Because is it big pharma's paying for them? Is it the U.S. government? I wonder if you can speak more to that.
Yeah, the two biggest funders are the U.S. government and pharma. So that's part of the difficult decision. If I have X amount of money, how much do I spend on basic science, just understanding how your neurons work? How much do I spend on coming up with a specific new treatment, a drug? And how much do I spend on an existing drug that I know that it works, but it's commonly not being used right? Mm-hmm. You know, all those are issues for research. A lot of the research I've done has been looking at people with multiple chronic illnesses and then looking for care gaps, care they should be getting that they're not, for which reliable treatments exist, and then delivering that care. That's different than looking at people that have, oh, treatment-resistant depression, have had umpteen different treatments and nothing's worked, and what is the new experimental treatment? So there's a lot of choices in research. But it's mostly pharma, and they fund things that they can get a patentable medication out of.
Yeah.
Or it's NIMH, and they do basic neuroscience as opposed to new treatments and hope that the neuroscience will reveal opportunities for new treatments.
Got it. You were talking about those care gaps. Can you speak a little more on that? What do care gaps look like? How do you work to close those?
Yeah. The biggest care gap is medication adherence. People only take medication as prescribed about 50% of the time, whether it's for a chronic medical illness or for a mental illness. And then we're surprised when the treatment doesn't work when they're only taking it half the time.
Oh, okay. Got it. So like, for example, I take 10 milligrams of Lexapro. If I'm severely depressed and like some days I can't get out of bed and take that medication, then that becomes a gap.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and most medications work pretty good if you can take the medication 80% of the time or better. But you get down around 70, 50% and you start getting symptom breakthrough, whether it's substance use disorder, depression, or hypertension. Another care gap is following up after somebody at hospital discharge. You know, you get out of the hospital, you're not at your best, you're not thinking straight anyway because you're still half sick because we discharge you so early. And we've usually stopped a bunch of your earlier medications, giving you a bunch of new medications. And we explain it to you when you're just thinking of getting home. You're not thinking about more treatment. And we give it to you with a stack of paper with a bunch of legal language in it, too, that's almost indecipherable. And then you make mistakes. So one care gap that is always good to focus on is having somebody call you a day or two later and say, okay, what did you understand you're supposed to do?
Yeah, and also just check in. How are you doing? I feel like that never happens. Too. Yeah.
Yep. And that is actually where a lot of the focus in improving care is that continuity of care. And that's a lot of, those are some of the indicators that actually certified community behavioral health centers have to measure that and report on that. And I think the public deserves to see performance report cards on their healthcare providers.
100%.
I mean, we get it on our washer and dryer.
But sometimes I do feel like, is it actually the physician or the hospital's fault, or it's just that they're spread so thin? You know, if the physician's working on like 100 cases or the nurse, how are they going to be able to call every single person 2 days later?
The system is not designed, our healthcare system is not actually designed to optimally deliver healthcare. It's designed to be economic stimulus and to deliver business opportunity. And it does that extremely well. But because it's not designed to do healthcare, it doesn't do that as well. It's much less efficient.
Yeah, it makes me think of also just preventative care. You know, think of like diabetes or heart disease. A lot of these medical issues are preventable if people are given the education and have access to certain types of food or exercise, or there's a whole thing we could trail down. But what do you think preventable care looks like in regards to mental illness?
I think it certainly is about early detection and treating people before they're so miserable they can't hold their job or it destroys their relationship. That's why we focus on mental health first aid. You know, at the federally qualified health centers, they're all using 9 questions called the PHQ-9, where when you come in periodically, they'll ask you these 9 questions to get at if you're depressed or anxious. That's preventive care.
Yeah.
The other preventive initiative we work with at the National Council is screening and brief intervention for risky alcohol and drug use. This is not designed to get to identify somebody that is alcohol dependent or is drug dependent. It's to identify somebody that's getting kind of heavy in their use and is likely to get into trouble. So it doesn't result in a diagnosis of, oh, you have alcohol abuse disorder, or oh, you have a cocaine abuse disorder. It's more about risky use, then we give you some information. You know, we say, well, you know, Aline, most people don't drink a 6-pack every night. And people that do, about 50% of them will have trouble with their job or with driving violation over the next 3 years. So you ought to think about cutting down because you could get in trouble. What a simple intervention.
And do you think this should start young, these conversations? Like, have you seen any research of like, if you start having conversations with middle schoolers or high schoolers, that there is a real difference of people who, you know, can acknowledge, or even people who are using these certain substances?
It's certainly important to start it in early high school as the teenage years come on. That is when people first start having their onset of illness, very common. Most mental illness and substance use disorders have onset in the teens or the early 20s.
And why is that? That's just when certain stressors are coming and or just your brain chemistry, biology?
I don't have a good reason. If I could tell you in detail, I would go get that nice prize they give in Sweden every year.
Okay.
But we know it is the pattern. We know it's how it happens.
Yeah. You spoke about in the beginning that the National Council advocates for federal funding dedicated to these mental health providers and substance abuse.
And it's not just funding, it's also policy changes. It's things like some of the expanded availability of using telemedicine for prescribing buprenorphine for treatment of opiate abuse. We work hard on that. It's some about enforcing the federal parity laws. Healthcare insurers are not supposed to manage the mental health benefit in a way that is more restrictive than they manage the general medical benefit. So they're not supposed to require more authorizations for behavioral health than they would for general medical care. They can't charge more deductibles or have higher copays. They can't make it harder for you to get care than to get your general medical care.
But I feel like most of the time it is harder.
And so do we. We don't think it's adequately enforced either at the state level or at the federal level. You know, the GAO, the Government Accounting Office, just 2 years ago did a review of federal enforcement of parity and found that the Department of Labor that's responsive has never issued a single penalty. They only investigate based on complaints. On others areas of insurance, they do what's called a market conduct exam. So they take a random sample and just look to see if there's problems. They don't do that on mental health parity. And they only got five people in the whole country investigating this stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've never even heard of that before.
Yeah, so the law's there, but Congress has not given adequate resource to enforce the law.
Well, also, I'm sure this changes every 4 year or 8 years, depending on what president we have. I'm sure it has an effect on all of these policies.
The country can only pay attention to so many things at once, and it's not always our turn. That's very correct.
Yeah.
But you know, clearly after the pandemic, people are very worried about substance use disorder and depression, anxiety. I'm hopeful in the near future of further improvement.
Do you see a difference in certain states when it comes to mental health and substance abuse?
Yes, there are widely varying rates in states that have not expanded Medicaid versus those that have expanded Medicaid. And the Medicaid expansion mostly covers people in early life, people in their late teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s. And it mostly covers people that don't have access to employment insurance otherwise. And that heavily is overrepresented in people with mental illness and substance use disorder challenges.
Yeah.
You know, that's Medicaid in many ways is the major behavioral health insurer in the country. If you think about it, if you have an illness you get early in life that can impair your ability to hold a job, it's going to mean you're going to have less money to pay out of pocket and you're going to be less likely to have work employment-based coverage. The nature and timing of the illness itself makes it likely that you won't get access to the best care the way our system's currently set up.
I actually spent some time at McLean Hospital in Boston last year. And obviously, up at the actual psychiatric hospital, they take insurance, but usually it's there, you're only in for a short amount of time and then your insurance kicks you out. So I did a program, a residential program, but the program that I did doesn't take insurance. And obviously, I'm very fortunate and privileged to have been able to not only take time away, but also be able to pay for a program like that. But that's not the reality of most people in this country. And I wanted to hear, yeah, for people listening, once again, just to reiterate, what kind of changes are we making in this country to make care more accessible, and maybe some hopeful commentary.
There was a landmark court case just about 18 months ago called the Witt decision. It was a class action suit against United Behavioral Health Care, alleging that they were not following the community standard of care in what treatments they agreed to pay for and what they didn't. And in particular, they were being over-restrictive on things like residential treatment. And they were not authorizing care unless the person was either was in immediate danger. And if they could be treated safely at a lower level of care, they would insist on it, even if that lower level of care was less effective treatment. And the court in Witt said, no, you have to authorize the most effective treatment, not necessarily the least restrictive. And it's really caused some changes. California has passed a law making that decision statute in their state. New York has used some administrative rules to push more in the direction of the Witt decision. It is a problem that often the companies are authorizing the minimum amount of treatment to get you just barely okay, as opposed to the amount of treatment that would be most effective for your illness,
Yeah.
which we certainly don't do for cancer.
Definitely. And so as an individual, as a patient, how do you talk to your insurer? How do you make sure, just even with this Witt decision, that you are being covered, that you have these rights?
So we put out a toolkit on appealing insurance decisions at the National Council. So if you go to our website and look for a Witt decision, you'll find our toolkit.
Perfect. And I'll link your website in the episode.
Great. And it actually has templates of how to write appeal letters quoting the Witt decision. and saying, you know, you should not deny me because of these reasons that were found in federal court.
Okay,
and we have phone scripts that you can use when talking to the insurance reviewer on the phone. And you can use those same materials to lodge complaints with your State Department of Insurance. Most insurance regulation occurs at the state level, and there really should be more people leaning on their State Department of Insurance to enforce parity. And then the third person I would talk to is, if you have employment-based insurance, talk to your employer. Say, look, you're paying my premiums, but they're not giving me care. You're not getting what you paid for because I'm not getting the treatment. And you pay these premiums so I can get treatment, so I can, you know, be a good worker here. And I tell HR that they're not getting what they're paying for.
True. I mean, even therapy. I see a therapist twice a week since I came out of residential treatment. I have diagnoses that are in the DSM. I'm on medication. And I see a therapist that I pay out of pocket, but then you can submit to insurance. And a lot of the time, even my insurance is like, we don't want to reimburse you.
Yeah. So your employer and you are paying a premium for something you're not getting. The policy says that you have mental illness coverage and you have access to a panel of providers. And in actuality, that's not true.
100%.
That is worth writing about to your Department of Insurance at your state level.
We have these tools to get what we're paying for.
Yeah. And, you know, let your local legislator know this is important, that I get decent. And, you know, there's some laws here, but people aren't following them. And we all need to get active.